This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My two guests would like to show Muslim women that women's human rights are compatible with Islam. Manaz Afkami is an Iranian living in exile in the U.S. She served as the Minister of State for Women under the Shah from 1976 to 78. She's organized an international conference on women's human rights education that begins tomorrow at American University in Washington, D.C. Afkami developed a manual for teaching women human rights in Islamic countries. We'll meet her in a few minutes. Azar Nafisi has used the manual to teach women in Iran. Nafisi is a former professor of literature in Tehran and is now a visiting scholar at Johns Hopkins University. Nafisi is going to share some of her experiences teaching women in Iran. She has used literature as the jumping-off point for discussing women's issues. One of the books she used was Lolita.
If you remember, the main character, the narrator in Lolita, Humbert Humbert, tries to take a 12-year-old girl who is a living human, changing human dynamic human being, and he tries to turn to fit her image into the love that he had lost in his past. So what he's doing, in effect, he is trying to turn Lolita into a figment of his own imagination, and in doing that, he destroys both Lolita and himself. And I thought that this was a very fitting image for a society in which its government, in the name of a past, of a fictional past, had tried to impose a sort of a static ideology on its living, dynamic, present.
Azar, when you hold workshops with women talking about human rights, women's rights, and Islamic law, can you hold this out in the open, or do you have to do it underground?
The workshops that I had after I quit school was in the privacy of my own home. So we were much freer to discuss what, we wanted to discuss. And also we didn't have that fear of, the dress code wasn't there. A lot of the codes which public would impose upon you, were broken. So the atmosphere was much more comfortable for both the girls and I, in which, we could, almost create a new sort of relationship, different from the one we had at, on the university level.
Did any of the women who attended have to get permission to come from their husbands or fathers?
They did have problems at home, a lot of them. One of them, in the process of that class, was when I left Iran, she was still trying to get a divorce from a husband who saw her participation in the classes as a threat to their married life. And later on, she wouldn't admit this to us for a long, long time. But later on, we discovered that he used to constantly beat her up. And she had been trying to get a divorce. And of course, this is one other thing. A lot of judges, because you see, in Iran, what has happened is that the civil laws have been put aside and you can use the Sharia or the religious laws. So what happens is that a lot of times when you go to the religious judges, they don't think that beating is enough grounds for divorce. In fact, I had one student who wasn't in this class, but she was telling me that her husband used to beat her, and she went to a lawyer. And the lawyer told her, well, my sister was being beaten, for the past 20 years. This is not enough. I can't defend you. And she said that at the court, the judge told her that she should look to herself and see what she had done wrong, which deserved, the beating.
Did any of the women in the groups that you taught justify that kind of law and say, well, I'm not happy about it, but I guess I deserved it, or I'm not happy about it, but I guess that's the way it is and I have to learn to live with it that way?
No. They did have a sense of guilt, and it came out in their readings and in the talks. Now, maybe if I could explain to you a little bit the situation that these women, were put in. You see, with Iran, I always have to remind people that Iran is different from some other Muslim countries. Each country has their own characteristics. Now, with Iran, unlike a country, for example, say like Saudi Arabia, where women still do not have the right to even drive a car, Iran was a modern country before the revolution. Women had a lot of rights. They had cabinet ministers. They had women in the parliament. They had women as an integral part of the workforce. So when the revolution happened, what was happening, this contradiction came about within the life of the society, where you had a modern past and now you were trying to impose a sort of fictional, reactionary present upon it. And women became the first targets. Now, my students, most of whom we could call children of revolution, were born and bred within this contradictory situation. On one hand, the books they read, the best things for them seemed to come from the past or from, quote-unquote, the West. From the videos, the books, the way they liked to dress, the ideals they had in life, the kind of relationships they wanted to create, the kind of even married life they wanted to have, all of this came from somewhere else. But reality denied them all this.
Did you teach this kind of material when you were teaching at the university in Tehran?
I taught the basic contexts of my teachings were related to Miss Material. If you take into consideration that the works I taught ranged from Fielding's Tom Jones to Austen's Pride and Prejudice to Wuthering Heights to Bellow's Dean's December, what I was trying to make my students understand was that, first of all, and like you see, Iranian society is politicized in the negative sense of the manner, in the sense that politics enters your most private thoughts. Politics is, you know, not something just public. It comes in with the Revolutionary Guards into your home. It has a gun in its hand and it tells you how to dress even in the privacy of your home. So what I had to make my students understand was how trying to understand and articulate their individuality, trying to create their private spaces, was an important social act.
Is this part of the reason why you're not teaching anymore?
Well, yes, it is because...
I mean, teaching at the university.
Yeah, it is part of the reason because by and by those private spaces which I was trying to create for myself within the public sphere became narrower and narrower. And it was very difficult for me to teach with this constant intrusion, you know, upon my physical body, you know, upon my mind, upon my gestures, because a lot of times the way I gestured, the way I talked to the students were questioned. Of course, I always
questioned by who?
Well, first of
all, the students report
I always had the problem of the veil. What I believed was that I'm not a political person, but what is important for me is to keep my identity as a woman and as a teacher and a scholar. And as a human being. Now, the first contradiction I came into was, in fact, in relationship to being a woman when I was teaching at University of Tehran, and then the law on the veil came. And I and two of my colleagues protested this law. And I protested it not because I thought that my protest would change the law, but because I wanted to make a statement to my students, letting them know that from tomorrow, if I wear this veil, it won't be because I want to stay on and carry on at the university, you see. That there is some principle involved, and this wearing of the veil is under protest.
What were the consequences for you at the university for challenging things like the law governing dress?
Well, from University of Tehran, of course, I was expelled anyway after a lot of skirmishes. At the last place where I was teaching, I was denied tenure. And there were things which I constantly had to protest against, which again were not political, they were academic, like the level of the levels the universities were sinking in, where more and more the students and the professors were judged and admitted based upon the ideology. One of my students, who was a very bright student, she passed the academic test and then she was denied entrance to the university because, you see, after the academic test, the students are supposed to pass this morality test. Where they ask them ideological questions about, you know, the Islamic matters. And also they go into their family backgrounds, into their personal relationships. And one of the charges, which might sound very funny to you and you might not even believe it, against her was that her face was very distinctive. It was very attractive. And the person who was interrogating her, and he finally failed her, told her that her green eyes attracted a great deal of attention, which sounds very, you know, strange when you say it out of context. But my students were penalized for laughing loudly in the halls. One student was penalized, and in her file, it says she is being punished for laughing of the giggling kind. Another student was penalized because she was late for class and she was running up the stairs, and she was forced to write and retract and say that, "I promise I would never run up the stairs even if I'm late for classes." So you see, the situation would become very absurd. And it was like a hit and run situation where the spaces would open for a while. There would be people within the university, within the government, who would look for these open spaces, and you would get certain chances of opening up, and then they would close again. And it became very exhausting.
Well, let me ask you, when you were teaching at the university in Tehran, did the female students who were the subject of all these very stringent codes and laws, did they object to it? Did they try to protest it? Did they rationalize it?
Well, of course, I think more than the students, there were us, their professors, who tried to rationalize. Intellectuals have an amazing capacity for rationalizing anything, as you can tell from the history of USSR and Eastern Europe. But the students, like the ordinary women in the streets, on one hand, had to submit to it and to rationalize it. On the other hand, they would show their protests, again, through signs which might sound very absurd when you say it out of context. For example, by wearing colorful scarves. Of course, you couldn't wear colorful scarves in the university, but outside the universities, or letting a bit of their hair show. In fact, letting a bit of the hair show became a sign of protest. It showed that, you know, you were objecting to your situation.
My guest is Azar Nafisi. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Azar Nafisi, a former professor of literature in Tehran who taught women there about human rights. She used a manual on educating women about their rights. The manual was written by Manaz Afkami, who is also joining us. She's an Iranian exile and the founder of the Sisterhood is Global Institute. She's the former Minister of State for Women's Affairs in Iran. She says that the laws regulating women's lives in Iran have created many absurdities there, and many of the women were raised before the Islamic Revolution, when Iran was a more modern country.
You have all sorts of absurdities, in the sense that you have segregated buses, but then on the other hand, people pile up on top of each other, men and women in the taxi cabs, which are not segregated. You have, on the one hand, a dress code which is so particularly severe, yet people are watching the latest films on video, Western films, and they're in contact with all sorts of modern concepts and ideas.
There's a new president of Iran, Mohammad Khatami, and he's seen as a reformer. In fact, women and young people were seen as the forces that really put him into office. Now, he has appointed a woman vice president, and he has also appointed a woman to Iran's culture ministry.
Deputy Minister of Culture, that's right.
Yes. Now, how do you think that this president might change the course for women in Iran?
Well, to begin with, if you notice, that woman was elected as assistant or vice president to President Khatami, but she does not have a cabinet job, so she did not have to be ratified by the parliament. And as far as I know, Manus, correct me if I'm wrong, she cannot participate in sit in the cabinet. And I think this is a very good example of the kind of contradiction that the Iranian government, Iranian society as a whole, but specifically the Iranian government, is facing. Because, you know, we keep talking about this past. Now, this past, they try to eliminate it, but it's very much present. So what the Iranian government government, the Iran, has had to face was a sort of a competition with the past. You know, the Iranian government has to say that it is progressive, that it has women in the parliament, that it has women in public sphere, and it has a woman as not a member of cabinet, but as assistant to the president. But that is as far as it can go, because the next step President Khatami takes, it would come into contradiction with the very law which has brought the Islamic Republic into power. With the very at the basis of this law is that women are by nature weak and they do not have the power of judgment. That is why within the Sharia law, two women. If you want to use witnesses to a murder or to a crime, a woman is counted as only half a man. If you a woman is killed by a man and the woman's family asks for punishment, they have to pay half the price of blood money because he has only killed half a human being. Okay, so you see the whole point, the question of women being appointed to cabinet ministers come out of that contradiction where the government has to prove to itself and to the world and to the Iranian society that it does have a modern view of things. But in practice, a lot of these women within with government jobs become ineffective because they have to reiterate a lot of these laws and they have to reassert a lot of these laws. So, for example, President Rafsanjani's assistants in women's affairs, Shahla Habibi, would constantly have to reiterate that women's first duty is to her husband and family, and the most important task of women is educating their children and creating their children as, you know, useful members of society. And I think this is a contradiction which President Khatami, this was a ticket that led to the election and victory of President Khatami, and it's a contradiction that he's going to face in the future.
What are some of the laws that you'd most like to see changed in Iran, laws affecting women?
You know, the problem is that the most important laws that have to do with the family, it's going to be impossible to change them within the present constitutional structure. So there may be laws having to do with employment or with, equal pay or with women being able to take part in educational fields that can be changed. But the most important ones on polygamy, on divorce, on guardianship of children, unfortunately,
age of marriage,
which is nine. You see, these unfortunately cannot be changed because of the whole infrastructure, the constitutional infrastructure. Structure and the whole presuppositions on which this theocracy is based.
So the age of marriage for a woman now is now nine?
Yes. It's nine, yeah. With the consent of the guardian, I think it can be under nine, in fact.
Yeah.
What are the laws about polygamy now in Iran?
Well, there is four wives and unlimited mut'ah or temporary wives, up to 100.
What is a temporary wife?
A temporary wife is a Shia, the Iranian sect, the sect that is practiced in Iran. They have the temporary marriage concept, which is that a man can contract a woman for a specific period of time in marriage upon the payment of or an agreement to pay a fee. And this could be from hours to years. So this is what is called the mut'ah marriage or a temporary marriage.
Is that seen as a form of legalized prostitution?
Generally, that's how it's seen, yes. Yes.
And does the woman have any say in that?
Yes, she has to consent to it. Yes, she has to consent. And usually the reasons that women consent to this, having in mind that virginity is so important, and once you've been a temporary wife, it's very unlikely that you can become a permanent wife and so forth. The reason that they agree is economic reasons, because this is one way that a man can support a woman financially, even if it is for a limited period of time.
We're going to take a short break, then talk more about women's human rights. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Manaz Afkami, an Iranian exile who now heads the Sisterhood is Global Institute, and Azar Afisi, a former professor of literature in Tehran who held classes in Iran on women's human rights.
Azar, you're teaching now at Johns Hopkins University as a fellow.
Yeah.
Do you consider yourself an exile, or are you going back to Iran?
Well, I would like to go back to Iran. I see it as my right, in the same sense that when I was in Iran, I saw it as my right to be who I am. And to tell you the truth, a lot of times in Iran, I felt like an exile. So that is the clearest I can give you in terms of an answer.
Do you plan on going back?
I do, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And Manaz Afkami, you do consider yourself an exile.
Oh, yes. Unfortunately, I can't go back. I'm on the wanted list. I'm considered a corrupt of the earth and a warrior with God. So unfortunately, I can't go back unless there is a change in the political situation.
And you're considered a warrior with God because of your women's rights work.
That's what my entire career in life has been, working with women's groups. So I guess this is what has caused my work. And, you know, my predecessor, the only other woman who was in the cabinet as Minister of Education prior to the revolution, was executed for also prostitution and warring with God.
What are some of the reforms you tried to do in that position?
Well, we tried to. It's not easy, you know. I mean, I don't want to put all of this problem to this particular government. There is also this social customs, the traditions and so forth. So within that context, what was done by the women during that period was that the family laws were changed, the rights for divorce were on equal footing, not full guardianship for children, but responsibility for certain aspects of children's lives were taken by the mother. The right to work without anybody's consent was gained by women. They had the right to work part-time with full-time benefits when they had a child for a certain period of time. They had long maternity leave. Abortion was free. So education in all fields was open to women.
When you worked in the Iranian government, mm-hmm. it was during the Shah's
yes.
Rule. Yes. And he hardly had a perfect human rights record.
Certainly.
What were some of the problems you were up against in the era of human rights and women's rights under the Shah?
Actually, you know, the problem during the previous regime was that people, although they had, the restrictions on cultural and economic and social life were minimal, there was, huge restrictions on political expression. But one good thing about that period was that although Shah himself, I think his role was the personification of patriarchy, and other leaders were not necessarily in any way you can call it feminist. But one thing that was there was that Iran wanted to be modern, wanted to be progressive, and wanted to be developed. And this was a stated purpose of the country. And one could very easily connect the role of women in all the areas of development, in education, in economics, in society, and so forth, with the idea of progressiveness and modernity. Also in the area of rights, although rights were limited in politics, you could always use this as the international public opinion as a weapon. When we have a country where they deny the importance of rights altogether, or that they say that universal human rights are not relevant at all, such as the present situation, it leaves very little room for maneuver. But when at least in principle, the country wants to be modern, wants to fit in, you can at least use that pressure of the international public opinion and also use the goals of modernity and development on behalf of women.
What do you find most liberating about living away from Iran, away from the restrictive women's laws?
It's you most probably.
Well, actually, what's liberating is that of course, you know, one has this access to all sorts of ideas, access to all sorts of activism, access to freedom of expression, and just as I can be talking to you like I am doing right now, these are privileges wonderful, positive things that one can do. And this is one aspect of it. The other is also the fact of being in exile, where you don't have some of the old rules that held you back, and some of the new rules somehow doesn't apply either, because this culture also has its limitations and its its own limitations on women. But somehow, in the as an exile, one has a certain leeway that allows one to express oneself in a bicultural way that gives even, I think, added possibilities.
For me, the basic thing has been to recover the control over my body. And I can read you something from what one of my students said to illustrate my point. She says, why should we cover ourselves? Why are we not allowed to feel the softness of the wind in our hair, the ray of the sun on our skin, the rain, the freedom, the pleasure? Why these beautiful sensations are denied us? Sometimes things become a habit for us and we do them without asking about their right or wrong. I think the same thing has happened here. We have grown so much accustomed to wearing the veil that we have stopped thinking about it and questioning its right or wrong. We have stopped thinking about the feel of the wind, the touch of the sand, and the sense of water on our naked skin. We have stopped asking why. So, you know, this is the first basic feeling that I have felt every time I've left Iran, in addition to all the things that Mahnaz has told you previously.
Azar Nafisi is a former professor of literature in Tehran and is now a fellow at Johns Hopkins University. Manaz Afkami is convening an international conference on women's human rights education tomorrow at American University in Washington, D.C. She's the founder of the Sisterhood is Global Institute in Bethesda.